Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. We open our show today with two national stories from the presidential campaign trail on Donald Trump's troubling ties to Russia and a call by watchdog groups for a criminal investigation into the Trump campaign's solicitation of foreign donors. In top local news, hear why the County of San Diego is offering incentives to landlords who will provide housing for the homeless. Plus, hear how the county's new report on the border fire left out some serious complaints raised by residents. We'll also have news about a public meeting coming up September 27th on the border fire issues and why the timing of that meeting is rankling some rural residents. We have a warning for parents today about a hazard for children found in a park in Santee. Then on Destination East County, guest host Charles Harrington Elster and Rebecca Williamson will tell you about all the most fun things to do in East County coming up, from a grape stomp in Julian to music festivals and more. Our newsmaker interview today is with Art Madrid, the former mayor of La Mesa, who is now running for the Grossmont Healthcare District Board. Hear his ideas for protecting and improving public health in East County. Then on sports, Liz Alper will have some good news from the Aztecs. Next up, Chisato Everson visits an exhibit at the La Mesa Historical Society prepared by Grossmont High School students on the internment of Japanese-American students during World War II. She interviews the museum's curator, who shares why she sees disturbing parallels between the past and present. Then we'll be replaying one of our Best of East County segments, taking you on the road to the historic Desert View Tower in Hakumba. We'll wrap up today's show with some national news headlines from Public News Service, including an announcement from the U.S. Justice Department about its plans to phase out the use of private prisons. We'll have all these stories and more for you on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Jonathan Getz with the latest news from the presidential campaign trail. It is illegal for U.S. federal candidates to solicit or receive campaign contributions from foreign donors. So why has Republican nominee Donald Trump's campaign repeatedly sent fundraising letters to foreigners, including elected officials in other countries, despite repeated warnings that this violates the federal election law? Two nonpartisan campaign finance watchdog groups, the Campaign Legal Center and Democracy 21, have sent a criminal complaint to the Department of Justice after multiple news outlets reveal that the Trump campaign ignored an earlier complaint filed with the Federal Elections Commission back on June 29th, The Hill reports. Fred Wertheimer, president of Democracy 21, stated, "It's inexplicable and impossible to understand why the Trump campaign appears to still be illegally soliciting foreign donations after they have been put on notice numerous times that this is illegal. There is no ambiguity about the fact that these solicitations are illegal." Multiple foreign officials, including members of the British and Australian Parliament, have confirmed receiving repeated fundraising appeals from Trump's campaign. A Trump spokesman has blamed the problem on scammers and claimed fundraising pitches were only sent to people who signed up to be on a campaign distribution list. But Terry Butler, an Australian Parliament member, sent The Hill an email she received August 14th on her government email account asking for a contribution. Butler says she never signed up to be on Trump's email list and has previously asked to be removed. Larry Noble, the general counsel for the nonpartisan watchdog Campaign Legal Center, told The Hill that Trump's failure to stop the solicitations, even after a criminal complaint was filed, amounts to, quote, "compelling evidence of the campaign's flagrant disregard for the law," end quote. The FEC and the Justice Department do not comment on pending investigations.
The Ukraine's new anti-corruption bureau has revealed that handwritten ledgers list $12.7 million in secret illegal cash payments earmarked for Paul Manafort, the campaign manager for Donald Trump back in 2007 through 2012, the New York Times reports. Manafort was a consultant back then for Viktor Yanukovych, the pro-Russian president later deposed. Criminal prosecutors are also investigating allegations that Manafort set up an offshore shell company to launder money for a Russian oligarch who is a close ally of Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. Manafort has denied receiving any of that cash. Manafort has told the Los Angeles Times previously that he's just an unpaid volunteer working free for the Trump campaign, despite the fact that he's previously been a hired consultant for a variety of high-profile clients, including Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos and former U.S. President Ronald Reagan. Is Manafort really unpaid, or could he be getting cash under the table from another source seeking to influence U.S. policy? Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, has issued this statement. Donald Trump has a responsibility to disclose campaign chair Paul Manafort's and all other campaign employees and advisors' ties to Russian or pro-Kremlin entities, including whether any of Trump's employees or advisors are currently representing and or being paid by them. But so far, Trump has not done that. Trump has baffled political pundits with his unabashed admiration for Putin. The Atlantic raised questions on Trump's pro-Kremlin stances. Trump has suggested that NATO is obsolete and should be dismantled. He's indicated he may not come to the aid of NATO allies if Russia attacked them. He suggested conceding Russia's annexation of Crimea in the Ukraine, even though that is widely viewed as a violation of international law. In addition, The Atlantic notes, Trump has expressed his admiration for Putin's style of leadership. The Republican Party platform recently adopted pro-Russian positions, including dropping an agreement to arm the Ukraine against Russia, sparking outrage among some conservatives. Manafort and the Trump campaign were suspected to be behind those changes, although the Trump team has denied this, the LA Times reports. The Democratic National Committee has blamed Russia for hacks into emails between the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign. Trump himself publicly called for Russia to hack in and get Clinton's missing emails, but later claimed he was only joking. Conservative columnist George Will said on Fox News last week that one of the reasons Trump may be refusing to release his tax returns is that they may show he's deeply involved in dealing with Russian oligarchs, CNN reports. An essay in Slate magazine titled Putin's Puppet concludes, "A foreign power that wishes ill upon the United States has attached itself to a major presidential campaign." And according to a Washington Post investigation, since the 1980s, Trump and his family members have made many trips to Moscow in search of business opportunities, and they've relied on Russian investors to buy their properties around the world. Donald Trump Jr., Trump's son, said in 2008, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." Why might Trump turn to Russian financiers? New York Magazine has observed that Trump's habit of refusing to pay back people who loan him money means regular American banks won't lend him money anymore, and that makes him dependent on unusual sources of financing. Just how much does Trump owe to Russian financiers of possibly dubious character, and if elected president, what might he be willing to do to erase those debts? Should voters be concerned over Trump getting daily security briefings and access to nuclear launch codes if he's beholden to foreign interests in Russia? Trump, in a late July news conference, stated, "I have nothing to do with Russia for anything." And he then qualified that by saying he had sold condos to Russians. The Washington Post gave Trump a 4 Pinocchio rating, calling those statements artfully deceiving. The Post documents numerous Trump family efforts through the years to secure major business deals in Russia, but notes that without seeing the tax returns Trump has refused to disclose, it's impossible to confirm how close his business dealings in Russia really are. A Slate magazine investigation has revealed even more Trump advisors with strong Russian ties and Trump's own association with Russian oligarchs, some with reported mob ties. This week, Trump announced some new additions to his campaign staff in the wake of all this criticism, but he has not dismissed Manafort or provided any answers to the increasingly troubling questions being asked about his Russian connections. Slate magazine discussed Vladimir Putin's pattern of stealthily meddling in other countries' elections to install leaders supportive of pro-Putin policies, and then concluded, "Donald Trump is like the Kremlin's favored candidates, only more so." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. San Diego area landlords, homeless people need your help. The County of San Diego and its partner organizations are looking for landlords who are willing to rent apartments to help house 130 homeless people. 30 of them have been identified through the Project One for All initiative. A program started in July to help homeless people with serious mental illness find a place to live and receive intensive treatment services. The county has invested over $16 million in Project One for All, which is expected to decrease hospitalizations, calls for emergency transport, and the frequency with which law enforcement responds to psychiatric emergencies. The other 100 people are homeless veterans who have received a Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing Voucher from the county, made available through the funding from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. All 130 people now have their funds to pay their rent but need to find homes. The Project One for All initiative was spearheaded by Supervisor Greg Cox and Chairman Ron Roberts. Cox says we need homes for vulnerable men and women who have no place to live. According to the 2016 point-in-time count, there were nearly 8,700 people without a permanent home in San Diego County as of January. Of those, 57% were living on the streets, and the rest were in temporary housing. 14% of people living on the streets had serious mental health conditions. About 13% of the homeless in San Diego County served in the military. To help them find homes, the county's Housing and Community Development Services has set aside $400,000 for a landlord incentive program. Under the program, landlords who rent to homeless veterans could get incentives, including leasing bonuses of up to $500 for each new unit leased, as well as financial help with security and utility deposits up to $1,600. But not everyone with housing vouchers can find a place to live. More than 100 people currently have vouchers, but the region's low vacancy rates and high rents make it difficult for them to find a home. So the county is offering incentives to make it easier for landlords to rent to veterans and help them get into a safe and stable housing. Landlords willing to help military veterans find homes can now call or visit 211 San Diego for information and referrals to all the organizations in the county who need housing for homeless vets.
San Diego County staff has completed its after-action report on the border fire. While the county report makes some suggestions for actions to improve operations and communications in future fires, it inexplicably omits many of the most serious concerns raised by residents. Those concerns include failure by law enforcement to mount a search for two people missing during the fire, a couple later found dead of fire-related causes by volunteers who launched their own search more than a week after the blaze. Many residents also voiced anger over inadequate help from the county for animals, including livestock and pets in the evacuation zone. Many animals died due to lack of food and water, although some were rescued successfully. Residents have also voiced outrage over lack of updates in those crucial first 2 days of the fire, as well as over lack of water for firefighting in Lake Morena, which was drained by the City of San Diego to below 3% of capacity over residents' objections. Potrero residents have also voiced concerns over the dangers of evacuating along Highway 94 with the fire burning on both sides of their town. They want to see a facility to shelter in place created, something county officials have balked at discussing thus far. Now, our news organization has contacted the county to ask if the public will have opportunities to have their concerns included in an amended update of the after-fire report on the border fire. Supervisor Diane Jacob has scheduled a follow-up meeting with concerned residents for September 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. in the Potrero Library. But if the county really wants residents' input, why schedule a meeting in this remote rural area on a weekday afternoon when residents who work in San Diego, an hour or more away, cannot possibly attend? Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jim Brewster with a warning for the parents of young children in the Santee area. A mother, Pammy Peterson, says she found dozens of thumbtacks at Mast Park, spread out and hidden in the grass, most pointing straight up. According to 10 News, Peterson made the disturbing discovery when she brought her three young sons to play in the park after tacks flattened her children's bicycle tires. She posted a photo on Facebook to warn other parents and says she notified the City of Santee's parks. She believes the tacks were put out intentionally to harm children. "I'd like to bring my children here and feel safe, and I don't. Parents should make sure children have shoes on and use caution in local parks, as should dog owners. Since it's unknown whether whoever put thumbtacks down in Mast Park may have visited other parks too,"
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This is Rebecca Williamson.
And this is Charles Harrington Elster, guest hosting Destination East County.
This week's Destination East County includes night fishing, a jazz musical, and the Ramona Country Fair.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including Grape Stomp, a bluegrass festival, an apple festival, and more.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
You're invited to drop a line at the last night fishing event of the season at Santee Lakes on Thursday evening, August 18th from 5 to 11:30 p.m. A lantern is required and no radios are allowed. Learn more at santeelakes.com.
Visionary Community Theater and City Ballet Orchestra presents All That Jazz, a concert tribute to the legendary team of Candor and Ebb at the San Diego Performing Arts Center on August 19th and 20th at 7 p.m. Composer John Candor teamed with lyricist Fred Ebb to forge one of the longest-running and most successful creative partnerships in Broadway history. Their bold, brassy style giving rise to a series of enormously popular and provocative musicals including Cabaret, Chicago, Kiss of the Spider Woman, and many more. For tickets and details, you can visit www.visionarydancetheater.org.
The Ramona Chamber of Commerce will present the 46th Annual Ramona Country Fair, Thursday, August 25th to Sunday, August 28th at the Ramona Outdoor Community Center. This real old-fashioned country fair will feature amusement rides, a midway of carnival games, a Wild West show, a country music concert, prizes, food, a stage for live music and entertainment, crafts, shopping, and contests for crafters and cooks vying for blue ribbons. A variety of crowd-pleasing hometown contests are planned, including pie-eating contest, frozen t-shirt contest, best mustache contest, and awards for best jams, jellies, honey, salsa, jerky, and pickles. Proceeds from the fair will benefit the Ramona community, including scholarships to Ramona students and support to other local events that promote Ramona as a destination. For more information, visit RamonaChamber.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
You're invited to kick off your shoes and come enjoy a day of fun at the 20th annual Grape Stomp Festa at Mangini Winery in Julian. This fall favorite takes place on September 3rd from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. There will be tons of grapes to stomp, plus wine tasting from several local wineries, food available for purchase, vendor booths, Italian music, and bocce ball contests. For tickets and details, you can visit julianca.com.
Santee's annual Bluegrass Festival will be held Saturday, September 10th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East. This year's musical lineup includes two talented bluegrass bands, The Homesick Hitcher and Mojave Soul. Admission entitles ticket holders to sample several varieties of wine, beer from numerous craft breweries, and food prepared by local restaurants. Proceeds from the one-night festival are used to fund recreation scholarship programs for seniors and low- and moderate-income families and provide annual operating funds for the Santee Teen Center. For tickets and details, visit SanteeBluegrassFestival.com.
Here's something to howl about. The Julian Music Festival on September 17th will benefit the California Wolf Center, which is working to preserve a rare and endangered wolf species. The music festival will be held on September 17th from 1 to 7 p.m. at Mangini Winery in Julian. The 47th Annual Music Festival will feature a diverse lineup of entertainment. For tickets and details, you can go to julianmusicfestival.com.
The annual Julian Apple Days Festival offers a weekend full of fun for the whole family on September 24th and 25th. It's part of the longer Apple Day celebration. The two-day festival will be held at Mangini Winery, featuring apple displays, music and dancing, an antique tractor display, children's games and activities, gold panning demonstrations, a beer and wine garden, food and merchandise vendors, contest, and of course, apple pie. For more information, visit julianca.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Art Madrid. Many of you may remember Art as the longtime mayor of La Mesa, where he served for 25 years as mayor and many years before that on the city council. But he's also been a longtime advocate of health care at the Grossmont Hospital, and now he's running for the Grossmont Healthcare District Board. Art, welcome to the show.
Miriam, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity so I can share with your listeners the qualifications and the experience I have that I think uniquely qualifies me to be a very viable healthcare district board member.
Very good, Art. Now, listeners, there are three seats up on the board right now. There are two incumbents running, Michael Emerson and Bob Ayers, and there are four challengers. There's Art Madrid, Priscilla Schreiber, who's been a longtime member of the Grossmont Union High School District Board, Jimmy Parker, who's a certified public accountant, and Virginia Hall, who lists herself as a businesswoman and nurse. So, Art, a lot of people would just fade off into retirement, you know, after so many years of public service, 44 years of public service. What compelled you to decide that you want to run for the Grossmont Healthcare District?
That's a good question. I think that what should be kept in mind is that I have lived in La Mesa for 62 years, and I've been involved in my community all that period. I also have a successful 35-year public sector career in a executive capacity, and 35 years as an elected official, 24 as mayor in La Mesa. I think it's important that if we have the interest and the time and the talents to contribute to our community, we should do so, and that's why I want to run for the board.
For those who may not be familiar with your history of advocacy for the public in this hospital district, can you give us some examples of some of the things that you've done?
Well, first of all, when the district was formed, it was outside the La Mesa City Council boundaries. And so the city of La Mesa went ahead and incorporated the district so it could provide additional services like hooking up to its various services, sewer and water mains and things of that nature. Now, since then, the district and the city have always had a positive working relationship, and I, as mayor for the last 24 years and 10 years as council member, have been very keen on the services provided to our residents living both in La Mesa and outside the district. One of the things that really surprised and startled me and made me get more involved was that in 1991, there was one healthcare district board member who wanted to close the pediatric unit in the Grossmont Hospital, which is a very essential and viable part of the core agreements that they have with Sharp.
So children's healthcare, they wanted to get rid of the specialty for children.
They did. The children here, and you have 500, over half a million people
wow.
being provided healthcare services by the district, of which at least something like about 78% are 18 years of age and younger, which would be pediatric unit potential patients.
So you got involved and led the effort to reverse that and get the pediatric care restored, I understand.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
And after that, there were other issues. For example, I was a strong advocate and supporter of the Proposition G, which was a $247 million bond measure. And the citizens in East County, the district, were very supportive of that. I think it was 77% of them approved that.
Yeah, which and really made it a state-of-the-art hospital.
Absolutely. Now mm-hmm. we have a hospital that is really a state-of-the-art here in not only just East County, but in California. The other concern that I have now is that the emergency room at Grossmont Hospital is the second busiest emergency room in the state of California.
Yeah, not surprising, really, because it serves all of East County. Other than, you know, Kaiser facility, which, of course, only Kaiser members can go to, there isn't another one. So if you're out in, you know, Alpine or Jacumba or,
you know, the mountain areas, Julian, this is where you need to go. And it just seems like it's a huge problem. So what is the answer? If you were elected, do you have some ideas for reducing the overcrowding at the emergency room?
Well, I do, and I think it's important that the healthcare district board work with the hospital administrators. And one of the things, when this came to my attention several years ago about the overcrowding, I started doing some research, and I noticed that the hospitals in Orange County have great solutions to that. And so what I would do as a board member, I would go out there and try to replicate those services, get involved with some of the administrators there, find out how they're doing them. And it's a successful program. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. If it's worked very well in Orange County, that's a very populated community, we should go ahead and do the same thing, and I think we can do it.
Another issue is patient privacy. The hospital, of course, it's made the news in a lot of positive ways in recent years, but one negative way that comes to mind is they had an issue where it turned out there were cameras in one of the delivery rooms, women's healthcare surgical centers, and the ostensive purpose was trying to catch a doctor that they thought was stealing drugs, but it also got video of some women without clothes on in very sensitive positions, and some of that got passed along to state regulators and even to the attorney of the doctor that they were going after. What would you do to better protect the privacy of patients at the hospital, Art? How concerned are you about what happened in that incident?
Well, two of the most important things, responsibilities that board members of the district hospital have is to make sure that the quality of services provided to the residents within the district are state of the art. And number two, to provide that kind of privacy for the records so that they don't get compromised. I would make sure that the issue that precipitated the need to go out there and expose those records or those films should have been handled in a different fashion. And we would work with the administrators at the district, at the hospital itself, to make sure that if they're going to go ahead and pursue certain investigations, they're not done in such a manner that will violate the privacy or even embarrass some of their patients.
Yeah. Okay. Another issue, Art, that I've heard you discuss is the concern over a deal that they tried to get with the community college to build a nursing facility in order to help, you know, train more nursing students to fill the need for nurses at the hospital. But somehow that never came about. Tell us about that.
That's another concern that prompted me to consider the serious campaign for the district hospital. One of the biggest demands for medical assistance and medical services are School of Nursing. My understanding is that Grossmont Community College had an overwhelming demand for student nurses, but they didn't have the facilities. So in an informal discussion, they talked with some of the board members at the district that they would go ahead and build, that the district would go ahead and build a facility to teach those student nurses to be certified. Now, before the agreement was even certified or agreed upon between the district and the community college district, a total of $3,750,000 were spent in buying some vacant lots and some very well-designed homes.
I remember that over on Wakarusa. The home was torn down.
Exactly.
and nothing happened for years and years and years.
Well, I think it was a total of 7 years where all kinds of money was spent, not only in buying that property, as I said, it was over $3 million, but they also had some significant architectural fees. They went ahead and designed the building, and they're going to promote the building and everything else. They did all of that without even having a formal agreement with the community college school district about how they were going to do it. Eventually, the whole thing just fizzled out.
Wow.
And as far as I'm concerned, over $5 million were spent. I wouldn't say it's malfeasance, yeah, but they weren't spent
that's
with
taxpayer money, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. How many of those currently on the board, or I should say, how many of the incumbents currently running for re-election were involved in that decision, do you know?
I think there are at least two.
Interesting. Well, we'll definitely be inviting all of them onto the show and asking them about that. There's a couple of statewide issues coming up, Art. One of them is that California voters are going to be asked in November whether to legalize recreational marijuana. Medical marijuana, of course, has been legal for a number of years in California. You've been critical of the current board for not taking a stand on that initiative, so I'd like to know, you know, what your stand is, but beyond that, if it does pass, what do you think the hospital board should be doing to prepare for whatever the impacts of legalization might be from a healthcare and a financial standpoint?
Miriam, one of the core principles that I've always had in dealing with management issues is to be proactive rather than reactive. And all you have to do is look at other communities or other states where the same problems that the district may be incurring have occurred simply because they did legalize recreational marijuana. The state of Colorado is a classic example of what happens when that issue was passed. The premise was that a lot of tax money would be going to the state and the cities, but the consequences of having some public safety issues of people who are driving around under the influence of marijuana creating some accidents, but more importantly, going to emergency rooms and hospitals, those costs are prohibitive. They're talking about almost in the $20 million category per year that are unfunded. And I think the district should be very, very concerned about what would happen to the hospital that they're responsible for.
If it does pass, despite, you know, the opposition of a lot of folks, what do you think the hospital should do then? Are there some things they can do to maybe better educate the public or sort of prepare for what these, or lessen what those impacts potentially could be?
Well, not just on this issue, Miriam, but one of the things that I would do as a board member, and, you know, quite frankly, there are a few board members that are totally isolated. They do not, to my knowledge, participate in outside community activities. But I think what I would want to do is call for community meetings throughout the 750-square-mile district. We have Descanso. I think you mentioned Julian and Ramona. All those are the legitimate taxpayers who own the hospital here in the district. And I would have those meetings so we could go out there and get their input. The other thing that we would do is make sure that to be proactive and visionary as to what some of the issues, medical issues that we're going to be facing, because currently the presidential campaign is such that people are promising that if they get elected, it's called now the Obamacare, but it's a healthcare medical.
Yeah, for the Health Care Act.
Yes, it is. And over, right now we have over 4 million people throughout the nation that have no medical insurance, and they're the ones that are suffering. And we have, we would have the same thing. It would probably double.
It was something like 42 million who had no health insurance before Obamacare.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now many of them have it. That's not to say it doesn't have problems. Certainly there's been some issues, but the people that are talking about rolling it back for the most part haven't really seemed to put forth much of a positive alternative. I mean, does that mean that we're going to go back to the days where an insurance company can deny you any health care at all if you have a pre-existing condition, for example? Is it going to be so unaffordable that even the poor have no way to buy insurance? So what are your thoughts about how the district should be preparing for the prospect that Obamacare possibly could be repealed, depending on who wins the election at the federal level?
Well, I think we should take into consideration, will that exacerbate the problem that we have with the emergency room overcrowding? And I think it will. So the district, in my judgment, should also be talking with the hospital, who are really the service providers, to find out just exactly how they can address this issue. Because whether they have insurance or not, we're still going to be facing some of those medical needs for those individuals.
Do you think that more can and should be done for those folks in the district that are indigent, that maybe can't afford their medications, some of these kind of issues that we see?
You know, one of the reasons that I've researched, and again, I'm impressed with what the hospitals in Orange County are doing, is that they're treating individual patients, even though they may be quite frequent visitors at the emergency room. They're now showing them respect as individuals. And what's happening is that rather than release the patient and they come back within 60 or 70 or 80 days for a variety of reasons, not taking their medication, not being able to afford to buy for the medication or other issues, they sit there and analyze the various challenges that they have, and then they work with those issues as well, because those issues are the reason why they keep coming back for medical assistance.
Yeah, expensive treatments, basically.
Exactly.
They wind up in the ER instead of just, you know, paying the cost of whatever the medication might have cost to keep them out of the ER. I used to be the editor at a national level of something called the Nutrition Business Journal, which was a trade publication that covered not only nutrition, but also sort of the cutting edge treatments and the scientific background and studies behind what originally was called alternative medicine, later complementary or integrative medicine, where it sort of took the best of Western conventional medicine, but also looked at the studies on things like, you know, when acupuncture or chiropractic or massage therapy might be a viable and even a less costly alternative than, say, surgeries and expensive drugs. I actually am a patient on the Sharp-Reese-Steele plan right here at Grossmont. And I was very surprised after I had a catastrophic car accident with some pretty bad injuries to find out that my Obamacare plan through Sharp has no coverage for chiropractic or massage therapy. There is no osteopath I can see. There's basically anything that relieves the pain isn't covered. Do you think they should consider having a complementary or an integrative medicine center where a patient can go in and be evaluated and not just say, hey, we'll send you off, we'll prescribe expensive drugs or send you off to a surgeon, but where they might incorporate some of these other sort of kinder, gentler, and frankly, less expensive treatments?
The answer is yes. One of the things that I've discovered during the research that I mentioned before about looking at other hospitals and other districts as to how they're treating some of those patients that are either indigent or frequent visitors to the emergency room is to find out just exactly more about the patient. Mm-hmm. Now, to be not to be criticized as being one of those nanny states, the fact of the matter is if you don't address an issue and you have medical experience now that they can go ahead and anticipate and look with a vision as to what some of the other issues, looking at the cause and the effect. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, I think if we can go ahead and look at the whole person and treat the entire person. Now, I can recall that acupuncture was verboten. It was not even looked at and covered.
Yeah.
They soon discovered that there are other medical ways of dealing with issues that we have not necessarily supported in the past that are just as effective. You know, so I think it's important to make sure that we take those things in consideration.
The National Institute of Health actually did a multi-center study at 5 major medical facilities, some of the finest, you know, university medical centers in the country, comparing acupuncture to arthroscopic surgery on the knee. And they really thought they were doing this to debunk acupuncture. And to their surprise, they found out that it actually worked better for more people and that the conclusion was that it should really be the first line of treatment before surgery is considered. So, yeah, I think there are some of them. You know, there's a lot of sham things out there in the alternative medicine world, certainly. But there are certainly some things where there's enough clinical evidence behind it that it's been shown to be effective. Listeners, I'd like to just read off here which communities are included in the Grossmont Healthcare District. Some of you probably live in it and have the opportunity to vote in this race and may not know it. But it includes the cities of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, El Cajon, and Santee, as well as the unincorporated communities of Lakeside, Alpine, Descanso, Pine Valley, Buckman Springs, Moreno Village, Campo Petrero, Tecate, Del Zura, Jamul, Spring Valley, Dehesa, Crest, and San Carlos.
That's a wide area of responsibility, and I think that we have different needs for all those clients out there. So that's one of the driving reasons why I want to be a member of this board.
Listeners, if you tuned in late, we've been speaking with Art Madrid, the longtime mayor and councilman in La Mesa, who's now running for the Grossmont Healthcare District. Art, I'm going to let you have the final say today. What else would you like our listeners and the voters out there to know that we haven't already talked about today?
Well, Miriam, thank you for the opportunity to go ahead and share some of my background and experience with your listeners. First of all, I'm a 62-year resident of La Mesa in East County. I had a very successful 35-year private sector career with a public utility, and then I've served my city for 44 years, 10 years on city boards and commissions, 10 years as a city council member, and 24 years as mayor. So I think that that experience, plus serving on a number of over 104 boards and commissions throughout the region, dealing with nonprofits, has enabled me to go ahead and be very capable and very much involved in my community. And those experiences are the ones that I want to bring back so I can continue to help my community here in East County.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you so much, Art, for joining us today. And listeners, we will be posting a podcast of this interview at eastcountymagazine.org in our politics section. So you can log on there if you tuned in late and you want to hear the entire interview. Art, thanks so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The La Mesa Historical Society has opened an exhibit on Japanese-American students at Grossmont High School who were forced into internment camps during World War II. The exhibit was prepared by Grossmont High School AP History students. Groups of three or four students each chose one Japanese student who was interned. The students published a book with their findings, including some first-hand accounts of quotes from relatives of the internment camp survivors. The internments began in 1942, shortly after the December 7, 1941 bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by the Japanese, and lasted until the war ended in 1945. It wasn't only immigrants who were rounded up. Even U.S. citizens and their children were forced into the camps. East County Magazine spoke with Donna Namir at the La Mesa Historical Society, who gave us historical context behind the internments, and later shared troubling memories from her own childhood of classmates locally who were interned. She explains,
"The United States was very, very afraid after Pearl Harbor was bombed, after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, that because we lived on the coast, that the Japanese here would give information to their ancestors or their relatives in Japan. So they didn't want them to be close to the coast. So they moved them inland."
The class project focused on seniors from the class of 1944. Looking at an exhibit of senior photos from the class of 44, the historian reflects,
"All of these people, were, except for one, were very, very active and were leaders at the school. He was the senior class president. He was very involved in the different clubs. There were athletes. One of them was a quarterback for the football team. They were all involved in either music, in sports, so they were really involved in their school and did a lot for the school as far as being leaders and wanting to go on to higher education, and so their aspirations and stuff were very high."
When the executive order was issued by President Franklin Roosevelt, each person was allowed to take just one suitcase. Eventually, they were allowed to receive mail, so family or friends could send them items. There was a school for the children and some activities as well as sewing machines to make things. Food was served cafeteria style. Some were allowed to leave and take jobs in the Midwest. The men could join the military and many went to Europe to fight for the U.S., the country that had interned them and their families. Of those who went to war for our military, Nymer reflects, the Japanese Americans wanted to prove that they were American, and that's partly why they fought. They did everything they could to prove that they were not the enemy. But some chose not to leave the camps because they were afraid of anti-Japanese sentiments and did not know how they might be treated by people in the communities they had left. After the war, some came home to find that they had lost everything, their property seized by the government, their possessions all gone. Others were more fortunate and found that their friends or neighbors had taken care of their belongings and some retained their properties. Nymir says her cousin told her about a high school principal at a local school who had students harvest strawberries at a farm owned by a man who was interned. She says they took care of the property, watered the plants, harvested them, and sold them, but they got the money. The Japanese American didn't. Despite all that they endured, the Japanese Americans did not fight against the internment orders. She says they continued to try to prove that they were good American citizens the whole time they were there. The modern-day student researchers at Grossmont developed an admiration for the Japanese-American students' strength and culture, Nymir adds. For Nymir, this project resonated personally. She was a student at Fallbrook High School when her Japanese-American classmates disappeared. She was shocked years later to learn that they, too, had been sent to internment camps. When her own Japanese-American childhood friends returned from the internment, she recalls,
"Actually, it's personally, it's very interesting because I was in school. I was in like in first or second grade when all of this happened. And I knew that my Japanese friends were gone. They, you know, but they never talked about it. We didn't know where they went. We didn't know, you know, and being that young, I never really questioned it. And it's never been, it's not part, I think now it's becoming part of our history. But when I was in high school then, it was not, the internment camps were never talked about. And I never was aware of it until I started working with the Grossmont High School students and started doing research myself. Did I realize how extensive it was as an adult? You know, so here I am 50 years, 75 years later, learning about this whole thing. And I think with prejudice and what the way we all feel about prejudice now, it's something that is very upsetting to me personally that it happened, that I had friends that went, and when they came back, they never talked about it. And but they were very, the Japanese people that I went to school with were very withdrawn, and they never talked about it. So I never knew that it happened to them.
There was no compensation for those interned until years later, when Ronald Reagan was president. She draws parallels between past and present. Here are highlights of her remarks.
But I see it right now reoccurring with the Muslims. And
Yeah.
So it's not like, I think people need to understand that they were American with a Japanese heritage, and that they wanted to prove that they were American, and that's partly why they fought. They did everything they could to prove that they were not the enemy, the Japanese who bombed Pearl Harbor. But it's an interesting concept. And I see it happening now, and it upsets me now with what's going on, when some of them, even my own relatives, they're Muslim, they're bad. And that's not true of any nationality.
We said never again after the internment of the Japanese during World War II, and yet it looks like it could possibly happen
with what's going on right now in our politics, which is very, very upsetting to me. I've always had my opinions about politics and my opinions about who's running the government and my opinions about stuff, but I've never felt that it would really bother me. It would really affect me, my own self. I could still have my own beliefs and my own, but I'm beginning to think if we're going the direction it looks like we may be going, that some things could happen that are going to be very, very negative and very bad.
Now she hopes the exhibit will help teach others about the past. The exhibit will be on display at the La Mesa Historical Society at 8369 University Avenue, La Mesa, through at least September. The museum is open the second and fourth Saturday each month from 1 to 4 p.m. Reporting from East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
This is Liz Albert with an Aztecs football report. San Diego State football was ranked within the top 25 for the second time in 1 week, as ESPN slotted the Aztecs in the 25th spot of its 2016 ESPN Power Rankings. Additionally, junior Rashad Penny was named to CBS Sports Preseason All-America Second Team on special teams. The Aztecs are the only Mountain West team represented in ESPN's poll, and only one of two from a group of five conference, said ESPN.com writer Mark Slabach of SDSU. If the Aztecs can knock off Cal at home and Northern Illinois on the road, they're capable of finishing 12-0 and representing the group of five in the CFP. ESPN projects a 20.2% chance for San Diego State to win the Mountain West and projects 9.1 wins. Penny, a junior kick returner and running back, returned 24 kicks last season for 804 yards and 3 touchdowns. He was one of 5 players in FBS play to have at least 3 kick return touchdowns, ranking 2nd in the nation in kick return average with 33.5 yards, and was named the Mountain West Special Teams Player of the Year. As a running back, he had 368 rushing yards and 4 scores on 61 attempts and 8 catches for 120 yards and another score. Earlier in the summer, Penny was named a preseason second-team All-American by Athlon Sports as a kick returner. The Norwalk, California native was one of two honorees on the list from a group of five schools. The Aztecs swept the preseason awards and captured all 29 first-place votes en route to being picked to win the West Division of the Mountain West in the 2016 preseason poll released last month. SDSU became just the second unanimous preseason pick in Mountain West history and is the only FBS team to receive all of the possible first-place votes in a divisional or league poll. The Aztecs kick off the 2016 season at Qualcomm Stadium against New Hampshire on September 3rd at 5:30 p.m.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hucumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hucumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hucumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, August 19, 2016. I'm Mark Richardson. In today's rundown of the news, the Justice Department says no more private prisons. Things are getting crowded this summer at one of America's favorite national parks. And protesters harness the power of music against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Up first, the U.S. Justice Department says it will end its contracts with private prisons, but watchdog groups point out that Homeland Security will continue to use them for immigration detainees. Andrea Sears reports.
A DOJ memo released on Thursday instructs officials to either not renew or substantially reduce contracts with private prison corporations as they expire. While that is welcome news to advocates of justice system reform, Gita Schwartz at the Center for Constitutional Rights says that only addresses part of the problem.
The Department of Homeland Security has made no announcement similar to the Department of Justice. So the bulk of federal contracting with private prison companies is going to continue through the immigration detention system.
Last week, the Justice Department's Inspector General released a report that found private prisons are less safe and less effective than government-run corrections facilities.
Privately run immigration detention facilities include two family detention centers in Texas holding up to 2,500 mothers and children. Over the last 8 years, North Carolina has cut higher education spending by 20%, and a report this week by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says those kind of cuts are having an impact on students' ability to succeed. We get more from Stephanie Carson.
In addition to cutting services, public universities in the state are raising tuition. Michael Mitchell with the CBPP says the high cost of college is putting a lid on what graduates can achieve post-college.
High levels of debt, even with a diploma, can prohibit newly graduated individuals from starting their own businesses and becoming entrepreneurs, which of course has implications not only for their own lives, but for the communities that they live in that would have benefited from having an additional entrepreneur.
Overall, the reduction in state funding adds up to $2,400 less each year per student. North Carolina did increase higher education funding by 4.6% in the last year, but public colleges and universities are still working with less funds than they did before the recession.
Yellowstone National Park is on track to break last year's record number of visitors. Attendance figures for July, typically the busiest month of the summer season, were up slightly, and the first 7 months of 2016 are up 6.5% compared to 2015. Charissa Reed with the park says since topping 4 million visitors last year, the impacts on the park resources have been significant.
Our staffing levels are still similar to what they were when we had just over 2 million visitors. So even though our visitors have increased, the number of staff to respond to those visitors has not.
Reed notes that people are the least studied mammal in Yellowstone, and the park's social science efforts are in full swing this summer. She says a new survey to document traffic patterns and heavy use areas should also produce insights into what visitors value most about the park.
One of the questions we're asking is, do they think it's crowded? You know, we're from rural Wyoming. We're used to a lot of space around us. But if you're from Manhattan, do you really think that Old Faithful Geyser is crowded in the middle part of the day? We don't know.
She says the survey results will help park managers make decisions to address visitors' needs and to continue to inspire and educate guests while still protecting the park's natural resources. A controversial plan to build a $3 billion gas pipeline through the heart of Florida has hit a snag, as three groups have filed a petition in court to block its construction. Mona Shand has details.
The Southeast Market Pipelines project would transport fracked natural gas across close to 700 lakes, rivers, and streams, and potentially impact nearly 2,000 wetland systems in three states. Raleigh Hoke with the Gulf Restoration Network, one of the groups filing the lawsuit in federal court, says people along the proposed route have been speaking out against it for years.
The public has continually been left out of the decision-making process for this project, and that's just not acceptable. Our water and our communities are too important to risk for the benefit of this out-of-state fracked gas company.
If built, the pipeline would extend through Florida and southern Georgia over an area that provides drinking water for about 10 million people. The groups Flint Riverkeeper and the Sierra Club are parties to the suit, which alleges the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers failed to properly notify the public or allow for input, and that the plans don't do enough to mitigate environmental impacts.
Activists in Oregon are using the power of music this weekend to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Eric Tegatoff has more.
Digital activist group Fight for the Future has put together Rock Against the TPP, which is touring the country to raise awareness about the massive 12-nation deal. Michael Shannon is head of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, which is sponsoring the tour. He believes the worst part of the deal gives corporations the ability to run roughshod over the regulations of involved nations.
They're taking aim at regulations that are designed to protect workers, that are designed to protect climate, and making those into trade barriers. The TPP would give multinational corporations the ability to sue nation states over regulations that they perceive as trade barriers.
President Barack Obama is embarking on a new campaign to gather support for the TPP, which he hopes will pass during the lame duck session of Congress after the election. Obama says the deal will make American products easier to sell abroad and also help the country compete globally with China.
Tegatoff says the lineup includes Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, actress Evangeline Lilly, and hip-hop artist and activist Talib Kweli. And don't forget to support News That Matters on our page at GoFundMe.com. I'm Mark Richardson for Public News Service, member and listener-supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.